The Lose Control Podcast, a paradox to peaceful, positive living that contains raw honesty and uncensored emotions. Matty I here. Thank you for listening to the Lose Control Podcast. We will hear inspiring stories from darkness to redemption that embrace the journey of living life on life's terms, leading to the discovery of your purpose. Welcome back, guys, and welcome to those new listeners. Please hit follow or comment in the comment section so we can improve and continue to serve you guys with the best, honest, and courageous stories out there of overcoming adversity at all levels, from addiction to trauma to shame, PTSD. We're all here together in this. This is week 8. We have Amber Fraser. My defects became my assets. Amber began her drug and alcohol use in 8th grade. She was a quiet, shy girl and wanted to fit in. Her drug use escalated to everyday use in her junior year. Her dad was a local politician, so she was constantly in the eye of public. In everything she was experiencing, the community knew about it. She began misusing prescription drugs. She has been hospitalized and institutionalized as a result of her chaotic use. In her early 20s, she recognized the overdoing of her drug use. She continued to tell herself she was having fun. Everyone was doing it, but not everyone was fighting, getting locked up, suicidal, running their friends over with their cars. She could not find her identity. Substance use disorder gave her that way to fit in. In 2017, she lost her job and was headed towards being homeless and left all alone in this world. Mid-2017, she stopped her illicit use of substances. She got involved with a 12-step recovery program and continued to find other ways through spirituality, through working with others. Today, she serves as a peer support specialist at the Courage Center in Lexington, South Carolina. She's also part of the South Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition Political Affairs Committee. She has found her purpose in helping others understand substance use disorder and educating the community. So few suffer in silence. She recovers loudly.
What's happening, Amber?
Good, good.
You have the day off today, you said, right?
I did. We had training all weekend, so yeah, I needed a day off.
Yeah, right? Every now and then we need that.
Yeah.
What was your training? What was it for?
It's called RAP, Wellness Recovery Action Plan. That's what it stands for. We took the training to learn how to to create our own. So it's like for a crisis intervention type of thing and just wellness tools. So we did that a couple months back, and then we did the train the trainer. So now we can train other people to, you know, create their own RAP programs.
Gotcha. Right on. Is that something through, it came out of the Courage Center? Right on.
Yeah.
How long have you been with the Courage Center?
2021.
Okay.
So I was first a participant and then peer support, volunteered some, and then started working part-time.
Is that where you met Jesse?
No, actually, funny story. I used to buy weed from Jesse. Yeah, I met him in back then, and then he came into Smokestack one day. I'm like, hey, I know you.
Kind of not ha-ha funny, but how we find circle back and run into some old running buddies, so to say.
Sure.
Nancy was a couple episodes ago, but she was 20 years I hadn't seen that young lady, and then I ran into her, same thing, through a friend that said, "You know a Maddie?" And she's like, "I only know one Maddie." And she saw a picture of me. He's like, "I don't know, but I had hair back last time she saw me." Peer support specialist at Courage Center, and that's you guys. We work mostly with, teens or young adults.
It was a program that first started out with families who have loved one that struggles with substances. And then, they added on the adolescent and young adult program. But we started a project back in 2020, I believe, with EMS. And that really kind of opened the door for, serving all ages.
I guess since, your 8th grade is when you started using. And it appears you had a tumultuous young, teenage years and younger in the 20s and whatnot. Is that what then brought you, for your, I guess, nothing short of your purpose now, right?
Yeah.
To really help others. Don't you, maybe we'll dive into just go from the beginning, like when this all started.
First of all, I'm a member and I'm in recovery from substance use and other mental health disorders. And for me, I started using around my eighth grade year. But prior to that, like my parents come from law enforcement background. They worked a lot of nights and I spent a lot of time at my grandparents' house. And there was a little bit of abandonment going on there because they would always just kind of leave me there. I love my grandparents, but I also wanted, you know, time with my parents too, you know. So they were just doing a lot of night shifts and it was me and my grandparents and then some of my cousins. I didn't really have that many friends kind of growing up in my younger years. I guess more into my teens is kind of when I made more friends and some of them, you know, they use substances and I wanted that connect because I was always kind of shy and you know, one of my friends shared with me huffing hairspray and aerosol, stuff like that. And
computer cleaner?
Yeah, stuff like that. Yeah. And then drinking and smoking cigarettes. And I just enjoyed that. It felt good. It was fun. It was, you know, I was, you know, just there was that connection, which I kind of struggled with making with other people. So did that for a little bit. Then you go into high school and it's nearly a prerequisite to get fucked up, you know. But then my junior year of high school, something traumatic kind of happened. That's where my trauma really kind of began. That led me into my chaotic use. My dad was a local politician. My mom had breast cancer. My dad was cheating on my mom. You know, she found out and gave him the chance, okay, you can leave her and then we'll go to therapy and stuff and be good. He agreed to that. 2 weeks later, my mom found out they were together again and came back that abandonment, right? So like, why am I not good enough for you to want to stay? That's what I kind of felt at that time. I remember they sat us down to, you know, kind of talk about what was going on and, you know, that they were splitting and stuff. And I listened for a little bit and then shortly after that, I went over to a friend's house and to talk about it. We talked maybe 5-10 minutes about it. And then I said, okay, I'm done. I'm going out. And then that's kind of when it became like an everyday kind of thing, right? I was overprescribed on my ADHD medication and, you know, drinking and then other illicit substances on top of that. You know, just some tips and tricks of how to manage my ADHD and non-stimulant medications to try to manage that. But I've come to the realization that, like, I do need something and that's okay. In my role as peer support, working with other individuals, it's kind of a fine line to talk about medications just because I can't prescribe and, you know, I can't diagnose or anything like that. I can just base off of my experience. They try to put me on some antidepressants and stuff like that. Again, I didn't have the education, but my thought was, I don't want to be dependent upon something the rest of my life. Looking back, it didn't make sense, but it made sense to me at the time. And knowing what I know and dealing with my traumas, like I have a chemical imbalance that needed to be treated chemically, and that's okay. That's kind of what I've kind of come to learn about myself and looking back on my experience. Yeah.
You mentioned traumas a couple of times. I know you, obviously with mom with cancer and you know, that, you know, the infidelity with your father, you know, was there other traumas that, you know, you can talk about or not?
That's your choice. Yeah, absolutely. And what really sucked about that time in my junior year of high school is like, that wasn't just a family affair. That was a community affair. Like everybody within the community knew what was going on. And that just made it worse for me. I know that I was made in like some local articles, media blogs about my behavior and stuff. And that's not good on anybody's self-worth. And then kind of just being in that lifestyle of substance use or chaotic use, you're kind of just there, things happen, you know, the people that you hang around, being wrong place, wrong time, sexual assault, different things like that. And then, you know, as my chaotic use progressed, you know, like there was a time, I was institutionalized, you know, medically and then within the justice system against my will.
I've been there against my will.
Yeah. I mean,
Now I go up there on Thursdays for my will, which is a beautiful thing. I love it. But yeah, I've been there. It's not a nice place when you're against your will there. So
really all the institutions were against my will, just in that lifestyle. And, you know, back in my chaotic use, I couldn't identify as someone with a substance use disorder because of what society painted that to look like. Right. I couldn't identify with that. Although I did have some of those things, there was a point in time where I was unhoused, where I was kind of just couch surfing, where the relationships with my family, they weren't going too well. Or even my friends, I was being institutionalized for different things. But again, you know, my parents being in law enforcement, they taught me this is what drugs look like. This is what that lifestyle looks like. And then the image that society or the movies kind of painted, you know, it's just, I thought that I was young, having fun, but maybe I just overdid it a little bit. And it was alcohol and uppers for me at the time and some hallucinogens.
What kind of hallucinogens? Mushrooms, acid?
Shrooms, acid, MDMA, cocaine.
That's a great combination right there.
Yeah, Molly, ecstasy, marijuana.
So how often were you doing these illicit drugs? Pretty every day, every other day, something like that?
Yeah. I may have taken like a day or two off during the week just to kind of recoup and you know, reboost my serotonin so that I could feel these effects, right?
I thought lots of chemicals I guess at some point in time, I know I read in some of your bio that, you know, locked up, suicidal. You have running over friends with cars?
Yeah, man.
Tell me that story. What's that about?
Yes. So I had a major drinking career. I loved 5 points. And I had friends who, you know, they were good friends. They weren't just using friends, right? They looked out for me. You know, they even reached out to my mom a bunch of times and said, hey, I'm really worried about Amber. This is what's going on. I don't know what to do. So one of my friends, you know, I was drinking, had my car and my keys, and I was trying to drive to go somewhere, probably to go cop something at another house party. And my friend was like, no, you don't need to do that. So she stands in front of my car to kind of stop me. I'm like, you either move or I'm going. So I went and kind of hit her. She was okay, but that's just not rational, you know? No.
Power of the drug.
But yeah, so that, you know, I still couldn't identify, but I thought I just did a little too much. So my solution was do what society expected of me, settle down, get into a relationship, maybe start a family, have a good job, get a house, you know, all those things. So I did some of that. I got into a relationship with somebody who was also someone who used substances, and his thing was more opiates and downers. I liked uppers, but one night he's like, you know, this one little blue pill, it was a Roxy 30. This one little blue pill will be cheaper than this bar tab. That made sense to me. So I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, let's do that. It didn't end up being cheaper in the end. You know, within this relationship, I came fully dependent on him, like mentally, emotionally, physically. Towards the end of our relationship, I didn't have a job. I had a car note that he paid. We were renting a house. He was paying all the bills. He was also paying for my habit. I really just didn't have any will to live. Our relationship was going south, but I stayed because it's what I knew. And I also didn't think that I was deserving of anything else. I thought that, you know, he's seen me at my worst and my absolute worst. And he's still here. Like, I'm not going to find anybody else like that, right? You know, oh, this is kind of a funny part. When I was younger, or when my parents were separating, right? This is future learned behavior. But when my parents were separating, my dad and his girlfriend at the time were in Charleston together. And my mom found out there was a trailer. We lived in a pretty nice house, but it was like a trailer that you haul stuff one in our front yard. My mom took all my dad's shit, loaded it up on the trailer, and then called my dad's girlfriend's husband to bring her shit and load it up all on the trailer too. So throwing shit outside, right? Later on in the relationship with my partner, that's something that I did. Anytime that we got in an argument, I take his shit and just throw it out the yard and say, get out. And this is over. He was paying for everything, you know, like I had, like, that's not, but I was hurt, you know, I wasn't happy with myself. There was a lot of traumas that weren't dealt with. And I wasn't mentally medicated like I should have been.
I've had those same behaviors towards my present wife, you know, we've been together for over a decade, but I don't know how many years ago that same thing is, you know, in a stupor, she had done wrong and I threw all this shit outside and, you know, stacked it all up. And looking back on it, it was obviously, you know, I could really look at it other than just being a complete asshole, like just angry at the world, but deeper into it and for somebody that's just unconditional love. But I just really wanted everybody to get away from me. You know, that was what I discovered was because I was so shameful of who I was, what I'd become. And in a fucked up way, that was, you know, how I, you know, and the anger actually masked all of the fear and the hate I had towards myself. So the easiest way would, you know, just get the fuck out of my life type of thing. Thank God, you know what I'm saying? That never stayed that way. But yeah, so I can relate to that insane thought process of So you got a shit all stacked up, a very dysfunctional relationship going on there with them. And how long were you together?
5 years. And at the end of our relationship, I didn't even have to throw his shit out. He just took his shit and left. His mom was going through cancer and it was progressive. So, you know, he had his own stuff going on. He was tired of my stuff, you know, and he had his own substance use going on and things with his family and stuff. And it just got to be a lot. So he left. And then that was in November of 2015. That's when my recovery journey began. That was really kind of the pivotal point of my process, really. So, you know, I didn't really know what to do.
Empty shell. Did he leave you with the opioid addiction, or wasn't for you because you were speed chaser? That was my world. I was a downer.
I was still with the opioid use. 2017. Okay. So when he left, my friend had told me about methadone, which is to treat opioid use disorder. I really didn't know much about it. She told me how it helped her and how it was affecting her and that it was for sure going to be there. And, you know, I was like, okay, well, let's do this. So, you know, I went. And when I went for my intake, they didn't give me any education on how this is supposed to help treat me and what it would look like. You know, it was the beginning of my process. And maybe in the first like month or two, I was still using I'd used a couple other opiates, but for the most part, it was just the methadone for my opioid use disorder. But I was drinking and then going into other like stimulant. You know, I started to gain back some of my independence, right? It wasn't always the best way to do that, but it got me to a place where I could, it gave me some what we call recovery capital, right? And once we have that capital, we can kind of build on that. And then our lives look a little bit better. So from 2015 to 2017, you know, I was working in service industry, and that wasn't a good place for me. And then 15 to 17, I was using other illicit substances, kind of staying away from the opioids towards the end and everything, but other things. And then the beginning of 17, you know, I'd lost my job as a server, and my dad employed me. He was in construction, specifically like asphalt road work. and stuff, and he employed me, and that was good for me. But I was also going to the methadone clinic every morning, and that was also good for me because it gave me that accountability. Today, the methadone system sucks. Now that I know what it is, it's a terrible process, but it's the only process that was available at the time. And the accountability did help me. That, and then working for my dad, I started to, change my people, places, and things. I wasn't using other illicit substances. From 17 to 19, I'd moved into a nicer place. I had a roommate, nice place. Only stay in contact with one person. She was my friend. We had a falling out in 2019. And then I'd moved out of my roommate's house and just moved in by myself. And that got to be a little lonely. I was just going to work, taking care of my pets, taking care of my responsibilities, going home and in bed by like 8 p.m. And that was working for me for a little bit until I moved out by myself and lost that friendship. I'd heard about a 12-step community, but I didn't really know much about it. But my thought at the time was like, it can go one of two ways, good or bad. So what do I have to lose, right?
So for years, though, for quite some time, I guess you said 2015 was when the kind of recovery world started to, come to start to create fruition, so to say. But I'm hearing you're just alone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just really a tough road right there, as today. I mean, as you said, keeping it together and actually having some improvements in your life, and still by yourself, that says a lot, man. It really does, because, was there during that time, up until, I guess, 15 was, because a lot of time alone, loneliness, is suicidal. And did you ever go down that rabbit hole?
No, because I want to say the methadone really kind of helped, like mentally kind of stable me out. It did play a role. Like I may have been a little depressed, but I wasn't suicidal or anything like that. I was just kind of lost. I didn't really know what to do. Didn't really have much direction. Recovery wasn't really talked about at that time. It was like a taboo thing. And it's still, we're working on stigma campaigns at the Courage Center, bringing awareness to substance use and treating that and recovery and stuff. But at the time, like that wasn't talked about, or, it's not something you wanted to be loud about. Right.
Yeah. Recover today, loud. That's where we're at today. That's the basis of this podcast was,
exactly.
Just it's okay. And, recover loudly and, few suffer in silence, and I heard that about 2 years ago on a podcast, and I was like, that's it. And and me in a 12-step program as well, is it's anonymous and don't talk about the 12 of AA to trying to market it, which by not by any means, but there's some hardcore people in there that are kind of, I think, missing out on what sobriety is all about. And I think that falls into your story, which you're about to go down that a little bit as far as the, but I won't take the wind from your sails because you know more than me on that. So that the being ostracized and being looked upon as a pariah, so to say. So 12 step programs. You found that as you're working with your dad and you're starting to get your legs under us and responsibilities, and the methadone treatments are doing what they can do for. So 12 steps.
Yeah. So I enjoyed the fact that there was a community, that I didn't even really have to tell my story, but people kind of knew. I enjoyed having somebody that I could share my experiences with. My second or third meeting, 12-step meeting, I went to NA first. My second or third meeting, I made the mistake of letting them know that methadone was something that was helping me. And, I had a bunch of, I had a good many of people who supported my methadone experience, but there were some naysayers who really impacted my self-esteem and didn't validate my recovery process. Although things were going pretty good for me, So, you know, I kind of just ignored it, put it in the back because I wanted that community. I wanted a place that I could recover out loud and just kind of share some of my experiences and just have human connection with people who are doing things different, right? So I kind of just tried to not pay attention to that. So, and then I got involved heavily with like service work and stuff. But, you know, I had some people who like harassed me on my being on methadone. They're like, so the basis of, you know, a 12-step program is service, unity, God, and self, right? I think those are the four pillars within NA. And they try to strip me of my service work, right? So I was chairing and facilitating some of the meetings. And one business meeting one night, a lady was like, you can't do that being on MAT. And I'm like, well, that's terrible. Like, how do you even know that? But yeah, so that didn't go too well for me. I changed home groups and I confided into another individual. This was my experience. And he asked me, and this was very profound for me, and it really shifted my perspective and self-esteem. He's like, well, what is your intentions of taking the medication? Is it to be well or to get high? I was like, well, it's to be well. And that made sense to me. So, you know, COVID happened, meetings kind of shut down. There was like one NA meeting that stayed open throughout COVID in my area and like two AA meetings. You know, towards the end of COVID, things started to open back up. You know, I was also doing H&I, which is hospitals and institutions, taking meetings in the facilities and stuff like that. Pretty involved with that, but COVID shut it down. And exiting the COVID era when things are opening back up, it was hard to find people who wanted to get H&S back started, right? Well, me and another guy were really adamant about bringing this because it really helped us. That same guy that asked me what my intention of being on methadone was later came back to bite me in the ass. But he went around to try to get people to go up against me and not allow me to be part of that service work, right? And that sucked. I even had someone reach out to me in my Facebook, on Facebook Messenger, are you still on methadone? At the time, I said no. When I was, I said no because I didn't want to be shamed. I didn't want to be judged. And I didn't want my service to be revoked, essentially, right? Which was a main pillar in recovery.
Yeah, no doubt. Some people are sicker than others. And you know, sometimes it's forgotten when we sit in a room and there's other sick people that aren't in 12-step program, but most of us that sit in have some mental health issues, drug addiction, alcoholism, and some people are really fucked up. Those of us that are able to put principles into our life to change, you know, really grasp the essence of what this design for living is all about.
And then, play a little devil's advocate in that is one, fear, right? Fear is a lot is what 12-step teaches. What are we fearful of, right? But that equates for that a lot of that discrimination that I experienced, right? That and then also lack of education and access to methadone, right? They treat you like prisoners to access this medication. So when you treat somebody like that, there's this negative connotation associated with that, right? So they're putting barriers for people to access what is considered the gold standard for opioid use disorder. And it adds to that stigma and shame. So there's a lot that, you know, our system has also contributed to that thinking, and then the fear, right? It's hard to consider a concept that differs from one that is helping you, right? Being in peer support has really kind of opened my eyes, one, to, you know, evidence-based practices for treating substance use disorder, but also like understanding how substance use and substance misuse works and, you know, opening up to the multiple pathways of recovery and something that in harm reduction too, right? Like we practice harm reduction every day in our lives. If you wear a seatbelt, use your blinker, wear a hard hat, right? Harm reduction is a social justice movement. It's a public health crisis. Substance use disorder is public health. It's not it shouldn't be treated with punitive measures. But that's how it's being treated today. But opening, you know, being serving in my role as peer support has really kind of opened my mind to these different understandings. And then also, I've come to this realization that like 12 steps did help me with a lot of things too, but there was a lot of, you know, mental health and trauma that 12 step did not address. And then also I did what I could to advocate for those who were silent about their medication assisted treatment. And I still do that today, but I could only tolerate so much mentally. So I removed myself from that. And that sucked because once I stopped doing what 12 step was doing, was telling me I should do, like going to meetings and talking with my sponsor and having sponsees and stuff like that, like the relationships that I built within that 12 step community, most of them kind of dropped me. And that sucks. That's not a good feeling. You know, we're all in this fight together. We should, unity again is one of the pillars, right? But we're creating this divide.
Oh yeah. I relate to that 100% because, you know, that again, the Lose Control podcast was not just for those of us in recovery or those that are, you know, wanting, you know, that have drug abuse or alcoholism going on. You know, that was the whole purpose of this was, the mental health side of us, the community, the world, the people, you know, we see every day because we all have the same emotions and the same feelings. Every human being does, and how they're able to process them and walk through life and make it as least trying as possible require, you know, some guidance and some blueprints that others might have done before. And it's, we can all move together forward on it. And then, but I, like I said, I relate to that because when I started this podcast started, and then, you know, there's some people in the rooms that are like, because it says at the end of the meeting, any non-related AA announcements, I certainly do. I go ahead and announce, and I can see some looks on people's faces. It helps everyone around you. You know, it helps, you know, my son, my daughter, my mother, my, you know, the relationships just grow because people see you change, and it's just positive energy. And the principles that we talk about, you know, are what we're living. And then that just, you know, is it can be infectious, not as infectious as negativity, but that's why we're like trying to get it together. But, yeah, that's one thing I don't care for is this, you know, it's them and us. It's the first right. People, and then there's alcoholics and drug addicts. And I hear that every fucking meeting, man. Oh, we're different. No, it's not. There's not a difference. It's not us and them, yeah. You know? And that's what I think is, I don't care for that, you know, just myself. But maybe you could hear that in my voice.
And a big part of why I was honored to be asked to be on your podcast today is one, talking about this kind of ends that stigma. And it also lets people know that we're not alone. The stigma is the biggest thing about substance use disorder, right? And there are a lot of different things that we can do to end that stigma. One, having conversations like this, recovering out loud, but also like the language that we use too. So if I go to a 12-step meeting, you know, they say, I'm an alcoholic named Amber. I'm an addict named Amber. I'm more than that. I'm not an addict. I'm not an alcoholic. I wouldn't say I'm a hemorrhoid.
You know? Right on.
I'm a person at first. I'm a person who is overcoming from substance use disorder. That doesn't need to be my identity, right? So, you know, things that we do to end that stigma is one, how we identify ourselves, not just for ourselves, but also within society, within the community, right? Because if we can't learn to respect ourselves, why should we expect anybody else to do that, right? So, you know, and another one is substance abuse, right? I never abused my substances. I took really good care of my substances, you know?
That's 100% right. They were done properly. You know?
Yeah, right. I took really good care of them. So, you know, another thing that we say instead is like substance use disorder. Just different things like that really kind of help in the stigma. It paints a new picture too, right? What is that? Well, let me tell you. And remember in the beginning, I was saying I couldn't identify as someone as an addict because of one, what my parents and them being in law enforcement told me it was, and then two, what society and what the movies and the TV shows paints, right? So we're painting a new picture by creating new conversations.
That's true. Yeah.
Oh, and another one is clean and dirty, right? That's a term that law enforcement created. Most of us with substance use disorder don't want to be associated with anything with law enforcement, right? Yet we're using that terminology. Clean implies that I was dirty, which I was never dirty. I was stuck in my health. Like, I wasn't taking care of my health. That's what substance use is. It's a health matter, not a punitive justice incarceration kind of solution, right? We use more clinical terminology, like, or just positive or negative. Like, you have a positive UA, positive urine analysis, or you have a negative urine analysis. It's not passing, it's not failing, because there's this, when you say someone passes, or when you say someone fails, if you fail, that sounds hopeless, right? It's not just because you've had a recurrence within your disorder doesn't mean you're a failure.
Right.
That means that you had a recurrence within your medical disorder. Those are just some other ways that, you know, we end stigma. So, you know, positive.
Yeah. That falls in lines of perception is probably one of the largest in my recovery has been my self-discovery of my perception I had on life. And,
right.
And, you know, in such a dark, negative way. And it's all been, you know, obviously I didn't help it any by putting myself, you know, ostracizing myself and becoming toxic from the ones, you know, that love me and I love, you know, all those, but I just had a brain fart.
I get that all the time.
I was going somewhere with it. Listen, though, so now that, you know, where are you at with your family? You know, because I know you started working for your dad years back and that was kind of helped you. But as far as that's just work and, you know, how about the relationship?
Yeah, my mom tells me I'm a lot more pleasant to be around now that I'm in recovery. And the relationship that I have with my dad, I have one. You know, prior, I was so angry and just hurt and sad and I had no coping skills and I was just really angry. So, you know, when I was actively using, I went to the extent of saying, like, I do not have a father. My father died when my papa died. Like, that's harsh. I wouldn't say that today. The relationship that we have today is awesome. Like, we call each other just randomly, like, hey, what's going on? I don't call him because I'm in crisis because I need him to bail me out of something, you know, like, if he gives me any money, he's like, he doesn't ask me to see the receipts anymore. He's just like, so our relationship's good. Me and my mom, we are like two peas in a pod. You know, sometimes we just go at it with each other, but I've learned how to, one, take responsibility for my actions, good or positive. When I'm wrong, you know, I try to make that right with her. The relationships I have with myself is good. You know, I respect myself today. I have integrity. I feel good about myself. You know, I don't feel that I need external validation from anything else. Feels good every now and then, right?
Hey, right. I'm only human.
But it's not something that I need today.
No, which is perception. That's what I was saying. It's back to it. We circled back to it because my perception was the same way as to all the darkness. The sky was not always falling. I wasn't really as bad a person as I, you know, I really thought I was a murderer or a rapist or just something horrible and disgusting. But, you know, and so my perception on life, and it always, the word get and the word got have always been in the English language, you know, but now when I put them together and I really look it back and I use this all the time and you guys listen and know everything was got to do this, got to do that, you know, and then this perception change and this, you know, new blueprint and mindset. Focusing on the positive and you get to do this, you get to do that, you know? So the perception and that's just what you're saying right there on, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly about, you know, having to be able to, this conversation you have with your, you know, when you talk with your dad, it's not because you want something from him or, you know, it's just, it's not a negative. It's just because, you know, we have a peaceful, loving, relationship, you know, and, yeah. And your friends too, you know, and before it was, you know, my mother said that, you know, the other day she was saying she didn't recognize me, you know, and she was, you know, because whatever I had done was just because that's what I do now is I'm a good, kind person. I'm a good, kind son. And she was just ribbing me. She's like, I don't even know who you are.
Yeah.
But you know, this is where this takes us, man. And it's beautiful on, you know, we don't feel mistreated and overlooked and discarded by, you know, because when my family discarded me, so to say, but they had to, you know, but I took it as a personal attack on me, not understanding that, you know, I was just, like I said, it was toxic.
My parents were hurting just as much as we were too, you know, and there's no parenting manual, right? You don't just automatically know how to cope with things either. You know, you got to learn that from something, and you learn that through therapy and treating your mental disorders, right? So they have their own way of dealing with things. And I, at the time, didn't see it as protection. For them, I saw it as they hate me. You know, they want nothing from me. But today I realized that, you know, they did the best that they could with what they had. And the coping skills that they had. And I'm okay with that today. But today, you know, life looks really good. You know, serving in my peer support role has opened a lot of doors for me. One, I get to advocate for what recovery is and be that voice for people who may feel silenced, especially with methadone or any other MAT treatment, right? I'm still on my methadone today. I've been tapering off since 2021. But I go at the pace that I need to, you know. I'm mindful of like my environment, things that are going on in my life and stuff like that. I'm okay with that. Some people might think being on methadone is a hindrance of like, your career or, being responsible or taking care of yourself. One thing that sucks about it is the weight gain, but, and then also having to, you know, the whole system of accessing methadone is trash, right? But today I get to use my experience to advocate for change, right? Just the other week, I had an interview with something called Safer From Harm. And they work with R Street, which is a movement to work within policy around different topics, you know, and they're working on one is called MODIS, the Modernizing Opioid Treatment Access. I think that's what it stands for, MODA. But they're bringing that to our legislators' attention to advocate for change for the current system for accessing methadone. That's the only medication that has restrictions on accessing it. That's crazy to me. But serving in my role today, I get to do that. I get to be a voice for people who are silenced or who are ashamed to speak up about a gold standard for treating opioid use disorder. A couple weeks ago, I was presenting in front of our medical affairs subcommittee, the Senate, about a bill that supports something called a syringe service program, which is within the harm reduction realm. I was able to present in front of our representatives about something that matters to me. Like, prior to that, prior to this process for me, that's not something I would do or think was possible or would really even entertain, because my dad with politics and stuff, you know, I swore off on never going near that or touching it. And here I am advocating for policy change.
And who better? So, and who better though, right? Who better right. than those of us that have walked the path when there's so much out there in regards to drug addiction or drug, you know, use disorder and, you know, abuse with alcohol and, you know, all of it is people on the other side, you know, that haven't seen the, you know, the gates of hell, so to say, or yet have even they've had this dysfunction, but they don't acknowledge it. So who better than those of us that have been there and actually have a real desire, a real drive, a real passion for unity, a real passion for real change that helps our fellow man, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
So it's a beautiful thing, man. It's crazy how it comes. I can't say full circle because it's not. It's just, you know, we go up like this. We keep climbing a ladder, and I'm always saying there's never a top to a ladder. Yes, you get up, you climb in the ladder, reach back and help someone up, you know? And that's exactly what you're doing. And That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So what do you have in front of you that's one of your goals that you really, you're working at?
Well, that's a loaded question. There's a lot of different things. I got my hands in
I was sure you had one thing that just is, that's working on or for you, your next, if there's another step to go or I know that Jesse had mentioned, I think, and William had mentioned that the Courage Center is probably going to be maybe some expanding.
We just opened up our Richland and Orangeburg location. We're receiving funding to open recovery housing where we are. We're getting peer support inside of the hospitals around here, the emergency departments. We have peer support and communication with the county detention centers. We have peer support who partner with the community paramedic with EMS to respond to overdoses or any kind of poly substance use. Those are things that we're doing. Other places in the country are doing something called wound care, which is treating, wounds, going out into the community, treating wounds to those who are underserved, overlooked, and essentially kind of discarded, right? There's a study who people with substance use disorder are most fearful of. And within that study, they found that they're most fearful of providers, right? Above law enforcement, which is crazy to me, right? So we're bringing that care to them at no cost. So I've created this wound care project where, we work with EMS to identify hotspots like high overdose areas or drug use areas, and along with the coroner and checking within these areas. So we go out in those communities. We have a wound care provider that comes out and volunteers her time. We have USC medical students. One of our participants is an RN who volunteers his time. He's a nurse that works inside of the ED. So he's very familiar with this stuff. So we do that. We go out off of that, but we meet basic needs because that's priority. Like that's how we make these relationships. I'd mentioned about that fear that people like us experience with providers. Just last week, I went to a doctor's appointment, and this is something I'm kind of working on. I went to a doctor's appointment last week to be treated to see about treating my ADHD. She comes into the office, pulls up my chart, looks at it and says, "Oof, I don't want to waste your time. I don't want to waste your money. I can't help you. I don't feel safe prescribing Adderall on methadone." There was no conversation. I didn't even go in there asking for Adderall, right? There are other ways that you can treat ADHD with non-controlled substances. Yeah. She didn't even have that conversation with me, We also have this partnership with Prisma Health in Richland County or down in Richland. They have this program. It's called the IAC team. Don't ask me what it stands for. Don't ask me what it stands for, but it's a program where they teach residents, medical residents, what substance use disorder is, how you can treat it, just how to work with individuals with substance use. I reached out to them. Hey, this isn't right. They also bring education to other providers too. I reached out to the social worker who works within that department. I was like, reached out to her, said, "Hey, I was in the heat of the moment. I was upset. I was hysterical. I called her. This is what it looks like. This is how I was treated." And by the end of our conversation, she's like, "Okay, what is her name? I'm going to report her. And we're also going to bring education over there." So that's something that I'm also kind of working on, right? I'm glad that it was me and not somebody else.
Right.
Because I have recovery capital to advocate for these things. I have relationships with these different partnerships to be able to bring that education in, right? If it wasn't somebody who had the capital that I do right now, it might have sent them off into a spiral that ultimately ended in death, right? Because that's what's going on today.
This is life or death.
Market.
Right. This is life or death, what we're talking about.
That's what I'm currently working on, right?
Right on.
Bringing that education and awareness and ending that stigma, especially with methadone, not even Suboxone or Sublocade. There are providers becoming more open-minded now that all providers can prescribe that. But there's still this nasty shame. I felt tainted. That's how that provider made me feel, tainted and not worthy of medical care because I was on methadone. Mm. And that's not right. Yeah. Well,
that's awesome. That's awesome. It really is. Education. That's what's needed, no doubt. And love and care, you know, the acceptance. And I thank you so much for giving me your time. And I look forward to, you know, us talking again in just like a year. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
To see how everything's grown and how we've changed and moved forward and the mounds of people that we've been able to at least, you know, give a helping hand to, of whether it's big or small, but just that little.
Absolutely. I've been hearing this lately. The efforts of one individual making change affects seven generations to come.
Wow.
Which is very profound to me, it right? Is.
Yeah, that's huge.
One individual are affecting the seven generations to come.
I mean, this podcast is
a positive way.
I mean, it's like over 1,000 listeners already. We're only 7-8 weeks into this and don't really, you know, that's not my background radio or anything, you know, and I think it was 11 countries too. My platform gives me demographics and whatever, and it's just super cool, you know, and
I've enjoyed listening to them.
You know, and there's so many more. I got, you know, there's 3 or 4 people that are lined up still talking. A couple of them aren't in recovery, but, you know, they drugs play into this role because usually they fall into, you know, when we fall apart as human beings, we go for something, a band-aid, you know, and it's right. to forget about the fucking moment, you know, but so look forward to us growing a relationship as we will. I'll be running into you down there at the Courage Center.
Well, Maddie, this was great. Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad we had this platform. And I hope you enjoy your meeting tonight.
I will. Thank you, dear. We'll right. talk soon.
Thanks, Maddie. Bye. Bye.
Listen, guys, the Lose Control Podcast, a paradox for positive, peaceful living. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Podbean, Podchaser. Please follow us, share. It's a beautiful thing.
Thanks for joining us. The Lose Control Podcast is committed to you becoming part of a healthy tribe, and we will transform our lives together.